everyone. I am very delighted and excited to welcome you to what is going to be a fantastic session. I'm James Colgrove, and I have the honor and pleasure of introducing our panel today, which is going to be speaking on private philanthropy and public health lessons from progressive era America. We have three fascinating historical case studies that will examine this topic. Private entities have long assumed responsibility for public health. Many early 20th century American public health campaigns were conducted by coalitions of philanthropists, corporations, and voluntary organizations working with governmental bodies. An examination of these coalitions' challenges can inform current debates on the proper place of philanthropy and the private sector in public health. Through these three case studies that we'll hear today, we will examine the unique role of philanthropy in the private and voluntary sectors in American public health programs and consider how these historical examples can be used to inform current debates over public health. So I'll first introduce the three speakers. Immediately to my left is Marian Moser-Jones. She studies the unique organizational evolution of public-private welfare state in America, especially in the realm of public health. She is an assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth University's L. Douglas Wilder School of Government and Public Affairs and its Science, Technology, and Society program, where she teaches historically grounded courses on bioethics, health policy, science communication, and disasters in social context. Jones received her PhD and MPH degrees from Columbia University's Department of Sociomedical Sciences and her AB from Harvard College. Her doctoral dissertation was Confronting Calamity, the American Red Cross, and the Politics of Disaster Relief, 1881 to 1939, which traces the emergence of this quasi-governmental institution as the single most important emergency response body in New Deal America. In the center is Megan Wolf. She is a PhD candidate at the Center for the History and Ethics of Public Health at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Her dissertation is The Value of Risk, Life Insurance and the Transformation of Public Health, 1894 to 1924, and it explores the manner in which the activities of the life insurance industry at the turn of the century helped to transmit concepts of actuarial risk into medicine and public health. She is currently a Mellon Fellow at the Institute for Social and Economic Research Policy at Columbia University and serves as the administrator of the Institute of the History of Psychiatry at Wilder Medical College. She received her MPH degree from Columbia University and her BA from Wesleyan. When not at work, she leads historical walking tours in New York City. And finally, last but not least, Robert Eldon Harvey is writing a book on the innovative advocacy of philanthropist and social reformer Elizabeth Milbank Anderson during the Progressive Era. While Anderson is primarily known for her founding of the Milbank Memorial Fund in 1905, the book will examine personal and cultural events which motivated Anderson in her transition from conservative Baptist to promoter of women's education, children's health, and social reform. Harvey earned his master's degree in public health in 2007 from Columbia University, where he focused on the history and ethics of public health. Prior to his work in public health, he was an investment manager in New York City. He earned his BA from Bowdoin College and MBA from the University of Virginia. So first up will be Marian, followed by Megan, and then Bob. So please join me in welcoming Marian Jones, whose talk is titled Patching Up Peril: Railroad Philanthropy and Early Worker First Aid Programs.
Thank you, James, and thank you all for coming to this talk on Progressive Era Case Studies of Public Health Philanthropy. Today, I'm going to talk about the American Red Cross Progressive Era Worker First Aid Programs, but primarily I'm going to place them in socio-historical context. No relationships to disclose, none of us do. So what do we mean by the Progressive Era? Well, this era occurred at the beginning of the 20th century, and in the U.S., its most iconic figure was Theodore Roosevelt. And it was characterized by a focus on reforming society to create a well-ordered world. marked by a concern with efficiency, order, and conservation in all areas of human enterprise, from industry and government to philanthropy. Now, this movement was sparked by several factors, principally the emergence of a well-educated professional class, also the excesses of industrial capitalism, along with massive amounts of immigration and rapid urbanization that led many in this new professional class to feel that the world, or to view the world as in need of reordering along more humane, efficient, and rational lines. So this idea of a world that was spinning out of control. Now, the last term, conservation, in fact, did not refer, as it still does today, just to conservation of natural resources, but just as often, if not more often, to conservation of human resources. This idea of a rational reordering of industry to avoid the needless waste of labor and lives. So this idea was based primarily on a concern with industrial efficiency rather than a concern with worker rights for their own sake. So why this concern with conservation of workers? Well, in a word, because of this growing awareness that industrial and other workplace accidents were taking too many lives. The Civil War was a terrible conflict, this 1912 journal article states, but its destruction of human life was insignificant compared with those killed and injured in modern industry. Now, this seems kind of like hyperbole. I mean, the American Civil War killed more than 500,000 young men. But interestingly, it's not written by a rabble-rousing agitator. It's written by a staid Columbia University statistician, a perfect representative of the progressive era with its penchant for statistics and professionalism to create this rational basis of societal reform. And this comparison of Civil War deaths and deaths in the wars of modern industry was repeated often at the time by people on different sides of the labor issue. But interestingly, this article adds, on a positive note, that policies of conservation of human powers and energies are rapidly taking the place of the reckless disregard of the nation's vital forces. So it's the nation's vital forces rather than individual human rights. Now, this comparison that I did of worker fatalities between 1913 and 2008, which uses data from the U.S. Bureau of Mines and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, reveals just why statisticians were expressing concern about worker accidents, or perhaps not exactly why, but you can see that worker accident rates were incredibly high, and they just started collecting national figures on worker accidents. And even in mining and construction, which today remain two of the most dangerous occupations, current fatalities, which are doubtless reported at higher rates than they were in 1913, make up only a wafer-thin slice of what these reported fatalities made up at the time. And this is also true of injuries. If you look at injuries of railroad workers and miners, again, only those that were reported, and you include all reported injuries and illnesses in 2008, the number now pales in comparison to those reported in 1913. So, and if we looked at severity of injury, I think evidence would indicate a much greater disparity. So what did that look like? Well, this is a typical railroad accident in the early 1900s. It's a bridge collapse in Arizona where the engine and three freight cars fell 25 feet. And the caption tells us that the engineer fortunately escaped with slight injury, but the fireman lost a leg and was badly scalded. Now, monthly trade union journals for railroad workers, which is where this comes from, were full of these stories where trains collided or derailed, engines exploded, railroad workers broke their necks, arms, and legs, and burned their faces and hands, and of course, often died. Now, reports of these incidents, though, didn't stay buried in the pages of tradesmen's journals. Coverage of railroad accidents became a staple feature of the sensational mass newspapers of the era. As industrial safety historian Mark Aldrich has written, press enjoyed few things more than a good railroad wreck. And so although the train safety problems had been mounting for decades as railroads expanded and pushed their rolling stock to their limits, carrying increasing passenger and freight loads amid the booming economy of post-1890, there was a depression, and then the economy started booming again. So during this period, the muckraking journalists really began to bring this this high accident rate to the attention of the public and to progressive reformers. Now, railroad work was not the only occupation whose increasing hazards were being sensationally revealed to the public. A series of deadly mining disasters sparked public concern about the need to improve mine safety amid increasing pressure to produce coal and metals for the fuel, the railroads, and industry. And the worst of these disasters occurred in December 1907 when a mine explosion in Monongah, West Virginia killed 362 workers. And in this picture, you can see the workers' bodies laid out in the center of town. Then less than 2 years later, in Cherry, Illinois, a fire entombed 265 miners, leaving these grieving widows, pictured here, to huddle outside for months in the cold, awaiting the return of their husbands and sons' remains from the death. And so at this time, state government officials, along with labor, business leaders, and some charitable organizations, began to ask what should be done to prevent recurrences of these tragedies. And the American Red Cross was one of the organizations that came to play a role in this. Now, the Red Cross movement had begun half a century before in Geneva, Switzerland. And it had grown not out of the carnage of industry, but the increasing carnage from mass warfare between modern nation states. And this is the Red Cross founder citing the Geneva Conventions. And in this modern warfare, soldiers were left with disfiguring and bloody and disabling injuries from cannon shot and rifles, and they'd been left basically by inadequate national medical teams to languish on the battlefields. And the founder of the International Red Cross, Henri Dunant, a humanitarian entrepreneur of sorts, sought to address the problem by organizing trained brigades of volunteers to provide neutral medical aid to all wounded wherever war broke out. And the first time these Red Cross societies got a chance to demonstrate their value was in the Franco-Prussian War, pictured here. It's the Swiss Red Cross aiding the wounded. So how did this movement go from addressing battlefield casualties to, in the US, addressing casualties of modern industry? Well, the route was quite circuitous. It began with Clara Barton, who was a Washington, D.C. female patent clerk, and she basically, she'd become famous for organizing freelance brigades of assistance to Union wounded during the Civil War. And after her Civil War work and her lecture tours from that, she had gone to Switzerland exhausted to recover. And rather than just following her doctor's orders and recovering, she got involved in the Red Cross work with the Franco-Prussian War and decided basically that the Swiss way of aiding, training to aid the wounded, and then providing this organized, neutral assistance to all parties was superior to the haphazard and partisan assistance that she had participated in during the Civil War. So she became enamored of the Red Cross idea and told the founder she was going to go back to the U.S. and start a movement in the U.S. But the problem was that in the 1870s and 1880s, there was no war. Aside from the skirmishes in the West with Indians in the East, there was no war to motivate Americans, ordinary Americans, to join such a movement. People, in fact, were anxious to leave war behind and focus on sectional unification and industrial expansion. So Barton, in fact, proposed that in peacetime, the American Red Cross would provide emergency relief in what she called, quote, national calamities, such as plagues, cholera, yellow fever, fires, floods, railway disasters, and mining catastrophes. And the post-bellum U.S. had national calamities aplenty. From the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, to the grasshopper plagues in the West in the 1870s, to the cholera epidemics along the East Coast, to the railroad wrecks, The Red Cross didn't need a war to keep busy. And in fact, under Barton, they kept busy with principally weather disasters like floods and hurricanes and a yellow fever epidemic or two, and left the railroad and mining disasters to the railroads and mines to handle themselves. But the volunteer-driven organization and donation-driven organization was reactive to popular pressure and to popular media coverage of disasters. And in 1907, after the Monongah disaster, and then in 1909, the Red Cross became the central player in providing relief at the Cherry Mine fire. And here's a Red Cross picture of men at the site of the Cherry Mine being trained in oxygen rescue apparatus to go and try and rescue trapped miners. Interestingly, though, along with providing relief for these major events, these industrial mining disasters, the new progressive era Red Cross leaders embraced this new rational progressive era concept of a national calamity. It didn't have to be an actual massive event. It could exist in the realm of statistics. So in 1911, Red Cross leader Mabel Boardman told an audience in Pittsburgh, quote, "The fact that 2,000 of our miners yearly lose their lives in the mines and that many thousand more are injured in their work is an appalling national calamity." And meanwhile, the Red Cross had received a charter from the federal government charging it with the duty to provide relief and to prevent national calamities. Now, the idea of first aid, which involved training volunteers at workplaces to provide immediate treatment before the injured person could get to the hospital, had originated in England in the 1870s with the St. John's Ambulance Society. And volunteers from this group were mainly doctors who delivered lectures on anatomy and wound triage. And this is a picture of a Red Cross book from England, to workers at factories and railroads, and eventually to the general public. And a volunteer from St. John's Ambulance came over to the US in 1900, contacted Clara Barton, and Clara Barton thought this was a wonderful idea and began to develop first aid programs for the Red Cross. But unfortunately, in 1903, Clara Barton was ousted from the Red Cross at the ripe old age of 83, and replaced by some of these progressive era reformers who wanted to make the Red Cross more effective. And they picked up the idea of first aid again in 1908, and this time focused it mainly on this issue of workplace injuries, which are then coming to the fore, and started to develop educational programs for miners and railroad workers. Now, the miners' first aid program involves sponsorship of contests jointly with the owners of the mines and state mine officials. In these contests, teams of miners, a group of which is pictured here, would compete with one another for a silver Loving Cup in mock emergencies, where they engage in triage, including proper preparation of splints and other bandages, removal of injured miners from danger. And they'd be graded on correct performance and on timing. Then the ARC also began to hold similar contests for railroad workers. And this is an advanced first aid instruction for miners. You see them doing the two-man carry. Eventually, the Bureau of Mines would take over this first aid program. But in 1909, the Red Cross also started railroad first aid, and they started a prevention campaign aimed at railroad workers and also passengers, basically trying to get them to change their behavior. Say, you know, don't put your head out of the car window, don't jump on or off cars in motion. And by 1911, the organization had instructed about 150,000 people nationwide. 2 years later, it claimed to have instituted first aid in almost every coal mine in the country due to the, quote, keen interest of the mining companies. And it also organized first aid classes among Bell Telephone employees and at large industrial plants, as well as among policemen, and had begun providing boxes of first aid supplies to mines, railroads, factories, schools, and gymnasiums. And so how did it raise the money to do so? Well, it was clever because the Red Cross raised money through revenues from sales of first aid manuals and the first aid kits it provided, and also charging for some of its classes. But it also received donations from wealthy individuals. And in fact, in 1911, Mrs. E.H. Harriman, the widow of the nation's biggest railroad magnate, contacted the Red Cross and said she wanted to donate funds for the railroad first aid program. Now, beginning in the 1890s, E.H. Harriman had basically bought up many Western railroads from Omaha to Oregon, including the Union Pacific. And in 1909, he died and left his wife as the sole executrix and beneficiary of his $70 to $100 million estate, which is about $1.7 to $2.4 billion in 2008 dollars. So she was one of the richest women in the country, and he hadn't set up a trust or foundation, which were starting to be set up at this time. And so basically, Mrs. Harriman was charged with the task of figuring out what to do with the money, and she was deluged with requests for donations. So why did she choose the Red Cross, and why first aid for railroad workers in particular? Well, she said that she was seeking to make donations that served as a fitting memorial to her husband, who she claimed had been especially interested in safety on his lines. Now, I think we can't really take her face value, and we have to say that, in fact, she was seeking to rehabilitate her husband's posthumous standing in the world. Like that of many Gilded Age capitalists, E.H. Harriman had really been tarnished, had his reputation tarnished by press criticism of his monopolistic business practices and his stock speculation. And in particular, he'd been tarnished by the Northern Securities scandal and by public criticism by Teddy Roosevelt. So what did Mrs. Harriman do? Well, she donated money to equip special Pullman instruction cars with a physician whose salary she paid and first aid instructional materials to crisscross the country, teach classes, and organize local classes where railroad surgeons employed by the railroad or local physicians could offer ongoing instruction. And these instructional train cars covered 25,000 miles each year. Now, apart from a Red Cross philanthropy, Mrs. Harriman also endowed the Harriman Safety Medal, which is still given to the railroad line with the fewest passenger and employee industries. So was this railroad safety a fitting memorial to E.H. Harriman? Am I being too cynical? Well, in fact, he had been the first railroad magnate to conduct detailed daylight tours of all of his tracks, and also to set up public accident inquiry boards rather than trying to whitewash the accidents. But his attitude towards safety focused overall on trying to improve worker performance through inspiring, i.e. intimidating, workers. On one occasion, for example, he was on an inspection tour and a flagman had failed to signal the train to slow down, and the train had bumped over this rough track. So in response, Harriman ordered the flagman and all the rest of the crew at that station to be fired, and said basically this type of heavy-handed action is what would prevent accidents. So Harriman's safety attitude did not evince sympathy for the plight of workers who worked 10 to 12 hour days and were often on short-handed crews due to chronic labor shortages, especially in remote areas, worked on night shifts and hazardous weather conditions, and had to deal with a constantly increasing load of freight and passengers. That said, unlike his successors in the Union and Southern Pacific, he'd been willing to settle strikes when they interfered with his empire building and financial dealings, and 6 years after his death, the workers were wishing, or some at least, were wishing for the days of Harriman. In fact, the years 1911 to 1915 spanned a four-year strike on the Harriman lines. Unions were fighting at this time for the right to federate. And this was the longest labor dispute in American railroad history, and quite a violent one. As the strike on the Harriman lines wore on, the railroad hired scabs and ran with shortages of labor, and of course, inadequately trained labor. And as one railroad machinist agent testified to a congressional panel in 1915, the railroad sent out trios of spotters to disrupt unions and to do so violently. And railroad workers also complained in their journals that this caused safety problems. In 1912, the Blacksmith's Journal claimed, for example, describing a couple of boiler explosions where numerous workers were killed, that, quote,
wreck after wreck has occurred in the strike zone, but the newspaper trust is keeping it away from the public. So what does it mean that the Red Cross program of Worker First Aid, financed by the beneficiary of the capital behind the Harriman lines, was being conducted amidst this major four-year strike? Could it be viewed as an attempt to displace responsibility for safety from the companies themselves to the workers, or to patch up a situation made perilous by the company's failure to settle the strike? Now, to be fair, Mrs. Harriman was not directly involved with the affairs of the company. She did many good philanthropic things, like giving money for the preservation of Yosemite, and you all know about, if you live in New York, Harriman State Park. She gave money for tuberculosis sanitaria. So she obviously had certain philanthropic interests in mind. And at the time, the Red Cross also professed adherence to this ideal of neutrality in conflict between capital and labor. But I think it's really impossible to decontextualize a program that focuses on worker training for safety to the exclusion of any improvement of working conditions or equipment and structure. Now, what about the mining first aid programs? Well, they also occurred amongst one of the worst periods of labor strife in the mining industry, which culminated in the horrible Ludlow Massacre of 1914, pictured in this cartoon. At the Ludlow Massacre, state militiamen, company security forces, and thugs attacked and burned to death 18 men, women, and children who'd set up a tent colony after they'd been evicted from company-owned homes during the strike. And interestingly, Dr. Alice Hamilton, the founder of occupational medicine and a friend of some Red Cross workers, asked these workers to intervene to help the families of strikers, as any Red Cross society would intervene in a war to help families. But after some initial willingness on the part of the workers to do so, the leaders of the Red Cross decided not to do so because they said it was a violation of neutrality. So the question I leave you with is whether you think this type of health and safety related philanthropic program was at all problematic. I mean, on one hand, it constituted an attempt to educate and empower workers, but on the other, was it really neutral if it ignored underlying structural safety issues, such as poorly maintained equipment, lack of mine safety equipment, exhaustion of workers during a 12-hour workday, and in some industries, the hazards and inequities of child labor? Additionally, it highlights the hazards that inure to any public health program targeted at workers, even to this day. And the question is, does the need to form alliances with companies in order to gain access to workers, and in the case of a nonprofit, to secure funding from those perhaps more sympathetic to capital than labor, compromise attempts to help the workers and promote their health and safety? So I'll leave you with that. Thank you.